Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
The global revolt for systemic change. Is education the first step out of history's white narrative? Former British minister and the first ever black head of an Oxford college, Valerie Amos, joins me. And... how popular culture has put the police on a pedestal. David Simon joins me. He created The Wire for HBO. Then... professor and psychologist Philip Goff tells our Michelle Martin that police and protesters should want the same thing.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour, working from home in London. For a third straight week, the worldwide uprising for justice continues. And as if to prove the protesters' point, yet another killing in America of an unarmed black man by white police. On Friday night, 27-year-old Rashad Brooks was shot in the back while fleeing after a breathalyzer test suddenly turned into an arrest and a tussle on the ground. His death has now officially been declared a homicide. And listen to what his niece and his lawyer are saying.
It wasn't like he was called there because Mr. Brooks had been swerving and was a danger to society. The first call was because a man was asleep. Where is the empathy in just letting him walk home? That's what policing is supposed to be, no matter what color you are.
Me and my uncle are both 27 years of age. 27 years of age. No one walking this green earth expects to be shot and killed like trash in the street for falling asleep in a drive-thru. Rashad has a family who loves him, who would have gladly came and got him so he could be here with us today.
So the fury mounts, and on Saturday here in London, a Black Lives Matter protest was cancelled because of threats by far-right groups. Bent on violence anyway, they clashed with police, and there are reports that some flashed Nazi salutes. Having denied the existence of institutional racism in the UK, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson now announces a commission to investigate racial inequality. My first guest this evening is perfectly placed to discuss all of this. Baroness Valerie Amos held cabinet positions in the government of Tony Blair, as well as top UN and diplomatic roles. She is now Oxford-bound, where she'll be the first black master of one of the colleges there. Baroness Amos, welcome to the program. Can I start by asking you, because you've obviously been writing a lot about this, can I start by asking you about this commission that the Prime Minister has announced? Are you satisfied by what the government is saying about institutional racism? And do you think there's an honest appraisal of what's happening even here in the UK?
Well, Christiane, you won't be surprised to hear me say that I don't think we need another commission. Just in the last 3 years, we have had, from the previous Prime Minister, a race disparity audit, which showed very clear inequalities across health, across our criminal justice system, across our employment system. We had a further report from David Lammy looking at the criminal justice system itself and the huge inequalities in that system. We had the McGregor-Smith report looking at the workplace, again, very clear evidence of inequality. We had the Windrush report, and just this year, the lessons learnt from that, 30 recommendations in that. And this week or next, we'll have the publication of the report on COVID, And very clearly inequalities identified in that report too. So what are we having another commission for? All it will do is delay. There are recommendations on the table already that the government can implement now. We need change. We need change urgently, and we need action.
So, again, my question to you is, clearly here and in the United States, there have been many reviews, many training programs, many reforms, and none have either been implemented or they have or they haven't worked. Do you believe this government is honest about the level of racism? I mean, the notion of systemic racism still here in the UK?
I think what the protests have showed, just not just here, but in the United States as well, and the fact that there has been, as it were, a global response with lots of protests in many countries across the world, drawing attention to the pernicious and pervasive impact of racism. The government has got to have understood by now that this is structural, it's deep, it's part and parcel of the way that our society functions. And we have to address it at that level. And I have to say that the response of the Prime Minister today, offering just yet another commission, does not give me confidence of that recognition. We have recommendations on the table. Those recommendations have been there for years. Let's implement them. None of us is saying that this is not a complex issue. If you look at the interrelationship, for example, between race and class. But you have got to start somewhere. There are deep, deep inequalities in our society. They are exacerbated by the racism in our society. We have got to tackle it. And the role, I think, of government is to recognize that and to help people, help everyone to understand it. There's a debate going on where there are lots of people who, I mean, I got a letter recently, just last week, from a man who told me that I had a chip on my shoulder. And the sooner I got the chip off, the better. I don't have a chip on my shoulder. I have spent years and years and years working on these issues. Of course I have seen some change, but that change is not fast enough. It's not deep enough. And that's what our young people are telling us. My generation, if government announced the commission, we would wait for the recommendations and see if they were implemented. The young people we are seeing now are tired of that because they have seen us wait and they have seen very little change. They've seen insufficient change. So they are saying, let's have some action now. So I don't think that the announcement of a commission helps.
These protests, clearly protests in the United States, in Britain and around the world, are leading the calls for change. It's not going to be top down, it's going to be bottom up. So I want to ask you what you make, for instance, of the attempt by members of the establishment here, there and everywhere to conflate protest with violence, protest with riot, and whether you think what happened over the weekend, which was clearly one group bent on violence, even after the Black Lives Matter was cancelled, does that finally put a full stop to this equating of who the protesters are?
I hope so. I mean, we have seen millions of people come out in peaceful protest, and yet so much of the focus has been on, you know, the sporadic violence you might have seen here and there. So I hope, I very much hope that that has put that to bed. What we saw over the weekend was absolutely appalling. Those far-right protesters who came out intent, absolutely intent on violence. So the black people weren't there because Black Lives Matter very sensibly said, let's change the date of our protest. They came out, there weren't the black people there for them to fight, so they fought the police instead. And the irony, Christiane, of seeing some of those thugs with swastikas, Nazi salutes, saying that they were protecting British heritage, they were protecting war memorials, war memorials to people who fought the fascists, the very people that they are now revering, that irony was completely lost from them.
And I have to say, even more revolting, we saw some of them, in fact, urinating against some of those memorials. So the disconnect was massive there. But of course, it does bring me to something that you're going to face at Oxford and something that the Prime Minister has focused a lot on. And we can see it happening in the US as well. The issue of memorials, the issue of statues. Let me just read you what the Prime Minister has said. If we start purging the record and removing the images of all but those whose attitudes conform to our own, we are engaged in a great lie, a distortion of our history, like some public figure furtively trying to make themselves look better by editing their own Wikipedia entry. What do you make of that view, and how will it affect, or what is your view about the Cecil Rhodes statue debate at Oxford University, where you're shortly to take up position as master of one of the colleges?
So, Christiane, I think the fury that people have felt about certain statues here in the UK, particularly about Edward Colston in Bristol, where people had tried for years, to get that statue removed. The Rhodes Must Fall campaign, which was very much about Cecil Rhodes, a white supremacist, and imperialist, forced labour in his mines that he established in South Africa and elsewhere. This is very, very different to saying that the complexity of our history, that the people that you have memorials to, who have a checkered legacy, that is very, very different. I would not call for the removal of all statues. We know that there is a historical context. We all know and understand that. But we also know that our history informs our present. It frames our future. There are some statues that should not be up. We should not be revering people who have been called by others monsters. We should not be revering them. Their statue should be in a museum somewhere with a very clear setting out of the history and what they have actually done. It's very different to have those leaders, those people who have said appalling things in their time, but who have also done amazing things in terms of showing leadership. That is very, very different. That is also a complicated and complex history, but that is something that we need to teach in our schools. We need people, when they go to see those statues, they need to understand. But I also think that because you put up a statue 100, 150, 200 years ago, to say that it must be there 200 years from now, when we have learnt more, we understand more, I don't agree with that either. But the crucial thing, I think, here is to make sure that we teach this history in our schools, that we teach the bad as well as the good. The way in which countries present themselves, if we're going to present ourselves as a diverse nation that is proud of who we are today is partly a product of that history. We have to understand that. My being in Britain today is partly a function of that slave trade, of the fact that slaves were carried from Africa to the Caribbean, to South America, to the United States. But in understanding that history, we have to understand the brutality of it and what that has meant in terms of how it's framed our relationships with each other as black people, as white people, as people who've come from Asia, from Africa to the United Kingdom. That's what I want. I want that understanding. I want our schools to teach that history. I want our curriculum to reflect that. So I think the Prime Minister
is this
focusing even on those statues, that just becomes a distraction.
Is there a way, I mean, you said you were absolutely staggered to find out that you were the first black female head of a university when you were head of SOAS, the School of Oriental and Arab Studies here. Now you're going to be the first black head of a Oxford college. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, you're the first black female to have been elected to the House of Lords. You've reached the top. How tough was it for you?
So first of all, Christiane, you're not elected to the House of Lords, so let's get that right. You should remember
yes.
that.
And yes, I said appointed first, and then I got all confused.
Yes, I was the first black woman in a British cabinet, and then I became leader of the House of Lords. And I'm very proud of that. And people are very proud of me for the fact that that happened, and that that happened in Britain, and that that showed what we can achieve in Britain. But I don't want that to be a one-off. I don't want that to be something that we keep pointing to in terms of firsts. We're still seeing far too many firsts here in the UK. We have young people who are talented, who have worked hard, who have played the game in the way that they have been told to. And then the door is slammed in their face. Or the ceiling, the concrete ceiling, they can't get through it. Why is that? That stubborn racism that continues. And they have lost patience. And I can completely understand why they've lost patience, because I've lost patience too. I've been doing this for so long. I expected it to be different. I expected it to be very, very different for the people coming after me. And it's not. And I'm not proud of that. And I don't think as a country we should be proud of that either.
So clearly there's a huge amount to do, a huge amount to do in terms of the state violence as perceived and enacted by those police who actually visit that violence and deadly violence on unarmed black people. And then there's the whole other institutional change that we've been talking about. Many are talking about, and you've just talked about education. Would you call for a complete change or an addition or some kind of established curriculum that teaches people in this country that it's not all about white supremacy, that, you know, that it is, there is actually another narrative in the world?
Absolutely. It's a shared history, Christiane, and it's a shared history that has affected all of us, even if we don't think that it has. So those people who, for example, write to me and say, take your hands off our history, it's my history too. So I think it's very, very important that we recognize and we acknowledge that. There's a black curriculum project that has been started, for example. It's garnered thousands of signatures because education and understanding who we are, where we've come from, how we connect up with each other is so, so important. So that's key. What we're trying to do in some of our universities, by looking at the curricula, by trying to make sure that we are decolonizing that curriculum. And I have to tell you that when we started to do this, and it was very much the students who were pressing universities on this, and that's exactly what happened at SOAS, the students led the way. When this was reported initially in the media, a lot of fun was made out of this. Now it is taken much more seriously because there's a recognition that this is about an additionality. It's about looking at things differently through a different lens. Universities are about knowledge. They're about creativity. They're about innovation. Let us open them up to that, rather than closing them down. That's what I want to see.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all of this and your incredible perspective. Baroness Valerie Amos, thank you for joining us this evening. Now, as a backlash against policing takes place, as we see, people are crying out to defund, demilitarize, and de-glorify the police. Since the dawn of the television age, cops have gained unprecedented cultural traction. But now, shows like Cops are being taken off the air after more than three decades. Joining me next is David Simon, perhaps the most successful police TV writer of all time, with The Wire for HBO. He started as a journalist for the Baltimore Sun, and he has written several best-selling non-fiction books on crime and policing. David Simon, welcome to the program. Can I ask you, David Simon, what you make of, for instance, this situation right now, given the fact that we've seen even at this time another killing in Atlanta, and all of the stuff that we're seeing going on in front of our eyes. Tell me where you stand on the issue of policing or the knowledge you gained in all of your journalism and your TV writing.
I guess I stand at about the same place I stood 20 years ago. Largely, as a result, unrelated to the TV writing, as a result of journalism, which is that the drug war and mass arrest and the militarization that, of police that accompanied the drug war, that has destroyed effectively quality policing and rendered irrelevant in some respects the police department when it our modern police departments in America when it comes to actually what job one should be, which is preventing violent crime or even crime with victims. Instead, we've become an army of occupation. This is something that I've been arguing since I guess The Corner, which would have been published in 98, is that we have to end the drug war and we have to end the notion that we can continue to use the handcuffs on our own citizens in these numbers and continue to police poor people and people of color to this degree over that which doesn't matter. We have to police people over what truly matters, which is victimization and crimes against people. But the rest of this stuff has just become a war on the poor and a war on the outsiders in our society. And it's been that way for now 30, 40 years. We've been building this one brick at a time.
So that's really interesting for me to sort of clock that you, with all your work and research, are tracing this back to the war on drugs when it first began 30 or 40 odd years ago. But I want to ask you to expand on what you said, army of occupation. You talked about in 2015 about Freddie Gray, who was killed in Baltimore. And you said, he's no way unique or remarkable. And then you told the New York Times, police weren't protecting anything. They weren't serving anyone. They were collecting bodies, treating corner folk and citizens alike, as an Israeli patrol would treat the West Bank, or as the Afrikaners would have treated Soweto back in the day. They're an army of occupation. That is a pretty stark and highly charged comparison to make there. And I just want to again ask you to pinpoint exactly what you mean and exactly what were the police like before 30 or 40 years ago?
Well, it's interesting. If you go back to the 1960s and earlier, certainly Baltimore was a predominantly white police department. In fact, almost a virtually segregated police department until the early 60s. And it would have been incredibly racist, and it was incredibly racist, and it was a raid against communities of color structurally. What's incredibly ironic about the war on drugs is that police department in my majority African-American city has been transformed so that more than half of the officers, and certainly most of the street police, are now African-American. And it's an African-American-led department for the most part for the last 20 or 30 years, with some exception. And yet, the brutality has, if anything, been sustained and has gotten worse. Meanwhile, the clearance rates, the arrest rates for things like murder and robbery and rape, the things that plague all citizens and that you would want to have a meaningful police response to, those have collapsed in my city. Take note, when the drug war ratchets up the arrest, when more people go into handcuffs, when we arrest more people for drug crimes, we actually arrest less criminals and we solve less crime. That's not an accident. So this thing has become, it actually goes past the simplicities of American racism, which are profound problems in their own. But it goes past the idea that this is just a binary problem of white police and black communities. This is classism. And the drug war basically allowed American policing to put off reform. And integration allowed them to put off reform for another two, three generations. these police departments have continued to over-police poor communities for that which really doesn't matter and doesn't improve the quality of life for the people living there, and under-police those communities when it comes to solving the right crimes and removing the people who are the repeat violent offenders. There's been a lot of great reporting on this. You know, that's the trick, is that it's not binary. You know, people who want to say we can do without the police, that's problematic too. That's problematic too. We can certainly do without this policing, but there are other things that have to happen in order for the city to become livable and fundamentally equal for everybody who resides there.
Okay, so I want to dig down a little bit more, because our previous guest, Baroness Amos, from a different perspective, also linked racism and classism, obviously. And you've just done it as well. And you've brought up the fact that Baltimore is now, I think I heard you right, majority black police force. And we've also heard from the mayor of Atlanta in response to the latest, obviously, violence there about the reforms that they instituted there. Can I just play what she said and then we'll dig more into this aspect of it?
We have implicit bias training in this city. We require people to go to the National Center for Civil and Human Rights. We have housing for our police officers in many of our communities in which they are serving in, but yet and still, it's not enough.
So what is the answer then? I mean, you've really touched on something that's fundamentally important, that it's not just racism, which plays a huge part, but it's also the other. What is the answer? Where do you see reform, having done so much on the ground reporting of this issue?
I know I sound like a broken record, but we have to end the drug war. We have to end the prohibition against drugs. It has become an overlay for the worst kind of police excesses. It has taught generations of police officers, and it's happened geometrically in some respects because we continue to militarize. And now the sergeants and lieutenants who learned how to do bad police work one generation ago, they're training the new guys coming in how to do bad police work. We have to stop that. We have to get back to policing. Policing is not soldiering. When you declare something a war, you have to have an enemy. And if you have an enemy, you're going to police in a different way than if you're functionally looking at a community as being the real estate that you're supposed to protect. The drug war has destroyed American policing. Now, that is not to say that American policing was clean or pure, or as we've noted already, the racism was inherent prior to the civil rights moment. But what's incredible is how little bump we've gotten out of integrating our police departments. You know, if it was purely about racism, that's been a constant in American life. And if anything, our police agencies have become integrated. And yet we, the public, the politicians and the public that elects them, we've asked them to do the wrong job. And we've asked them to do the wrong job, the job that basically creates not a policing agency, and not something that protects people and responds to real crime, but we've created agencies that are basically targeting communities and are teaching the cops that the metrics for advancement as a police officer, which is, you know, money, overtime, court pay, or rank, that these things are tied to mass arrest and to brutal policies of occupation rather than quality policing, rather than going out and locking up the right guy for doing the right crime, which is what it's about, the only job we need the police for, but it is an essential job.
So I want to ask you then, what sort of person goes into the police force? What sort of qualifications, what sort of pay does a rookie police have? You've just explained how the advancement works on those metrics, but what kind of education and basic training do they get from the get-go?
Well, I'm going to say the education varies. You actually get a bump if you have a college degree in Baltimore. I can only speak to Baltimore. I think Baltimore, the entry right now is about $53,000 a year. It's a civil service job. You know, if you get past your probationary period, you've got all the security of a civil service job in a prioritized agency. There's a lot of critique of the performance of police unions, not merely as collective bargaining agents to secure pay and benefits and bargain collectively on behalf of their membership, but as politically political entities, lobbying entities that have been arguing for a ratcheting up of police powers and of the policies of mass arrest and mass incarceration. You know, I'm on the board of my writers union, of the film writers union, and we're in the AFL-CIO. We just took a vote, my union, to ask the AFL-CIO membership to remove police unions, which is an extraordinary act for anybody in collective bargaining. But the idea that, you know, I believe in collective bargaining for every employee against labor. I believe in that. But I can no longer abide by the notion that they're going to argue for these policies that are so damaging to so many other working people in their fellow unions.
The whole structure of
what it takes to be, listen, there are good people who join police departments to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And then they're put in the maw of a structural system that is basically saying, we're putting you out on the street to police a drug prohibition in areas where American industry has completely abandoned the central city, where jobs are scarce, where the drug corner is always hiring, where in, you know, every third house in certain blocks, somebody might be drug involved. We're basically asking you to police them as if everybody's the enemy and if everybody's subject to the handcuffs. And once you do that, it doesn't matter where you came from. You're going. It's where you're going. You're going to become part of Pharaoh's army, and that's what we've created.
Okay, I need to ask.
We must end the drug.
Yes, well, exactly. All right. But as you know, and we started with this introduction, that police have been glorified in American culture, whether it's on film or in television, in books, whatever it is. Some of them have now been removed from the air in response to what happened to George Floyd. Just where do you fit into this? I'm going to get into The Wire in a second, but what do you think about the glorification of police on television? And has that played into a sort of invincibility, top of the pyramid kind of characteristic?
Well, it depends on the television, doesn't it? I mean, I think beginning with Dragnet, going back to the very beginnings of the police serial, the idea of the police as the thin blue line has been the paradigm. And the idea that they were enforcing laws that we all collectively wanted enforced was the assumption. I mean, I don't feel any need to defend The Wire or The Corner, which are the two pieces I did and was that I'm responsible for. They in fact exist as an actual critique of the drug war. They're arguing that the policy itself is not only structurally unsound, but it's contributing to the disaster, that we have to walk away from this stuff. So, you know, what we did was an actual argument against the structure as it exists. That said, there is something in the American psyche that's fascinating, which is, you know, we probably have two cultural art forms that are our own when it comes to film and television. Maybe three if you count the musical, but that's sort of theater. But we had the Western. And the Western, the iconic American Western, was always one man stands between chaos and civilization. He may not be a part of that civilization. He may be a gunfighter. He may be the loner. But he's larger than the law, and he's bigger than life, and he will affect change. And that is the power of the American Western going back to John Ford. Now, the Western is passé. Our frontier is closed. We no longer ride horses into the sunset. But what we have that is our frontier is the urban frontier, are the cities and the portions of American cities where some people think they dare not tread. It is the Wild West in our minds. Mm-hmm. It's not. These are communities that need to be addressed as if they're part of America. But this is the culture of the American Western has now been grafted on over generations to a lot of programming about police. So the idea that the officer who's bigger than the system, who's bigger than the law, who is all that stands between you and chaos, that has its origins in the American Western, in our own sense of ourselves on the frontier. Maybe I'm talking in film theory, but a lot of what used to be in Gunsmoke and Bonanza and all that stuff was delivered to the police procedural, and not for the better. And to be honest with you, when it came time to work on The Wire, we had a lot of fun taking a flamethrower to that, because it's done an immense amount of damage to my city and others.
Well, yes, and it was described as a form of protest television. I assume you agree with that. And one of your actors said, "I think The Wire really tore the cover off an American city and showed that for so many people, the American dream was dead." In our last 30 seconds, your comment.
Oh, I don't know. Listen, a lot of people watched the show and got involved in, you know, it was Stringer cooler than Omar. And you know, a lot of people watch the show and they're not thinking about what the intent is. You can't write for them. You just got to write what you're trying to say. But listen, nobody ever got poor underestimating the American television audience. I got to admit that.
Well, David Simon, thank you. And of course, yours all came from the beginnings of journalism, so it had an extra gritty reality to it that, unlike many of the others that have been written, thank you so much indeed. And we dig further into policing with our next guest, who is a leading scholar on law enforcement and race. Philip Atiba-Goff is a psychologist and CEO of the Center for Policing Equity, think tank that collects and analyzes data to shed light on police behavior and fight implicit bias. He tells our Michelle Martin that making the police force match the times boils down to one key relationship.
Thanks, Christian. Professor Goff, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
You are one of the foremost authorities on the issue of policing and race. How did you get interested in this subject? I mean, it seems in a way like a subject that's been hiding in plain sight, but you brought kind of a rigor to it that just wasn't there before. How did you get interested in this?
I mean, honestly, I fell down the rabbit hole just a little bit before other people did. When the nation was starting to talk about mass incarceration, I was in graduate school, and I thought that was the direction it was going to go. But in 1999, when I graduated college and moved to start my PhD, there was a very famous shooting, Mamadou Diallo. And what happened in that shooting shook not just the nation, but also the field of psychology. Because what happened, there were 41 shots put into his body. 41 shots fired. And they said that they saw a gun, but in reality, he had his wallet in his hand. Now, that's the kind of sort of cognitive illusion that psychologists love to be doing in laboratories. And all of a sudden, we realized the stuff that we do in the lab could matter in the world. We fast forward 9 years later in 2008, I was writing a little something about policing. I thought policing was going to be part of my work. And at the end of it, I wanted to add a statistic about police brutality or just police use of force of any kind. I started middle of the day, I ended 13 and a half hours later, and I got up and I walked home because I realized the reason I couldn't find that stat is because it didn't exist. So in a world where someone can get shot 41 times for a trick of the eye, that we didn't measure anything about the way that the state treats its most vulnerable, most oppressed folks, Black folks, Native folks, that seemed impossible to me. And I realized as I was walking home, this is just going to be what I do for the rest of my life.
One of your early research subjects that got a lot of attention focused on misapprehension of the age of Black children. I mean, you started with Black boys. And one of your findings was that people in the sort of the target research group, which was mainly, you know, white male police officers, routinely misrepresented the age of Black boys. So could you just talk a little bit more about that and why that matters?
So ours was the third of the sort of published studies to find something like that effect, but it was the most, no pun intended, arresting, because it had on-duty officers, and it also had pictures of the boys. So you were literally looking at a 13-year-old boy, and not just officers, but lay folks, college students and regular everyday citizens were seeing them as 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 years older than they were. And when we got the data back and we saw that Black boys were given an extra 4.5 years, meaning someone who's 13 gets treated basically like an adult, we thought, wow, that's really difficult to swallow. I'm not sure that effect isn't just an accident of the subjects or an accident of, you know, the pictures we showed. But I believe later that year, it was in Cleveland, that Tamir Rice was shot and killed. And here clearly the officer saying, Black male, 20 years old. Tamir Rice was 12. And that was part of how I knew the things we were getting in the lab were likely underestimations of what we're seeing, what people are experiencing in their lives.
It's one of the things that has intrigued me about the current moment is that you're seeing two different sort of philosophies around policing and why these issues persist. On the one hand, you've got the bad apples argument. It's just some bad apples. And that they've got to do better at weeding out their bad apples. And yet you've got other people saying, no, this is a system problem. And the systems need to change. So talk to me about that. I mean, which is it? Is it bad apples or is it a system problem?
Yeah, it's a question I'm getting a lot, and have been since the Floyd murder was first captured and broadcast. I have to say, all of these conversations, the way that we frame them, I think, frankly, it's because it's easier to frame a conflict, which is what we're seeing in the streets, as if it's an ideological conflict or a group-based conflict. I got to say, that's not the way that we've done our research. That's not the way that we see the field. When I go and talk to cops for the last 12 years, and I'm a black man from Philly, I did not imagine that my life was going to be police chiefs being like, oh, thank goodness, Dr. Racism's here. But that's what it looks like. They invite me in and they're like, all right, don't say this out loud, but there's some racist cops in here. Help me get them out. Also, we shouldn't be going in communities and acting like social workers. I don't want my cops trying to de-escalate a domestic dispute unless we think it's going to get violent. Why am I sending a badge and a gun to go deal with someone who's trying to kill themselves, right? That they need mental health services. They need substance abuse services. Cops, chiefs all the time saying, what can I do in a community that has no grocery stores, no educational facilities, none of that stuff? How much of that sounds exactly like the protesters? And the chiefs have been saying this for decades. So this idea of, oh, don't do incremental, we've got to defund versus, no, we have to be responsible, defund is lunacy. That's a distraction by people who profit from distraction. There is a straightforward adult path towards aligning our public safety systems with the values of communities. We should walk that path, and everybody trying to distract from it should go to bed so that the adults can do what the adults have to do.
So I want to talk to you about what that path is, but first I do want to ask you, why do we keep having, 1,000 people killed by police every year?
So one piece of it is because the full humanity of black people has been invisible since the founding of the country as it stands right now. So if you can't see someone's humanity, you can't see the things that cause them pain. It's just illegible to you. But I think the deeper piece of this is we've never had a full accounting of the ways in which we have targeted black communities for abuse and erasure. I've been saying it now for weeks. What we've been seeing on the streets is not just a policing problem. It is a past due notice on the unpaid debts owed to black people for 400 plus years. And since we haven't bothered to account for it, when you have a debt that keeps coming due, you're likely just to pay off pieces of the interest, none of the principal. So the reason it doesn't change is because we're not scaling our problems, right, to the full measure of the issues. We're arguing about tactics when we first have to reckon with scales, right? If you want to say to me, oh, I think we can kill this beast with a knife, and I say, no, we can beat it with a stick, right? A third person comes in and says, you remember the thing that you're trying to kill? It's 200 feet tall. Those tactics are not the problem. The problem is we haven't reckoned with the scale. And until we do, we're going to see it over and over and over again. That involves recognizing the full humanity of the people who've been speaking, centering our voices. But it also involves an honest accounting of history, something this country has been notoriously terrible at since we started.
So let's talk more about, you say, your path, the adult path here.
Right. And so I hope you won't find me too terribly difficult, but the protesters are asking for policing and, right? So there's a range of things that people mean when they say defund the police, right? Some mean literal abolition. Communities can just take care of it themselves. But most of the protesters I talk to, most folks in black communities that I know, want just less of a footprint. They want literally the same things the chiefs have been asking for years. Scott Thompson, used to be the chief in Camden, New Jersey, wanting to say, give me a Boys and Girls Club, I'll give you back 10 officers any day, right? And it's that kind of thinking that is part of the adult path, right? We used to have mental health hospitals in this country, right? Now, they had a terrible history, right, and awful abuses, but there was public funding for mental health services, right? If you could get that right, you would have less of a need for law enforcement to be the only place you could call when something like that is happening, right? We used to have significant investment in public schools. As that gets lifted up and thrown away and we privatize more of that, you end up saying, well, these folks are rowdy because they haven't eaten, right? These folks are unruly because they have to go work jobs after school, starting middle school. And so we put police in there instead of nurses and counselors and doctors, right? So the ACLU, I think a couple of years ago, came out and said 14 million kids go to school in a school that has police, but no social workers, nurses, counselors. How on earth is that the right thing to do? Police have been calling for this. Now, because it comes with a slogan that feels scary to some people, people are intentionally not hearing what it could mean.
Perhaps it's a ridiculous question to me. You say that the chiefs support this. Why don't they do it?
So a lot of chiefs have actually been trying. I think part of the reason why we see it is because it fits our narrative that cops are racist thugs. And for sure, I have met cops who are racist thugs. But across the country, a lot of chiefs have been embracing a number of these reforms. Part of the reason why we haven't seen it is because culture change is hard. You have folks who have union guaranteed contracts. It's very difficult to fire them. So between 2006 and 2017, about 1,800 officers who got fired in major cities, about a quarter of them had to be rehired because of the ways in which contracts were set up. So it's hard to fix the culture if the bigots can't get fired for being bigoted. That's a portion of it, right? The other part is that in major cities, at least, the average tenure of a police chief is about 2.5 years. So let's just imagine I'm a bigot and I see someone coming in trying to change the culture. I'll be like, I'll just wait them out. So that is not an excuse, but it's part of the reason why it's so hard, right? That said, I think, frankly, there hasn't been the kind of urgency where you say, if I'm only going to do this for 2.5 years, I'm going to make sure that I really move the needle on culture and nothing else. So there hasn't been the outside pressure to say, if you don't get this done, we're going to hold you accountable to this value. And that, I think, is the thing that I want everybody to understand. We hire and fire police chiefs to manage the crime rate. The crime rate ticks up. It doesn't matter how wonderful they've been. They're out. We need to be thinking about hiring and firing chiefs and superintendents, commissioners, voting for sheriffs if they do justice. And it's that value that means we, the people, are going to give or withdraw our consent to be policed this way to the degree that we're having law enforcement within our communities. We haven't held them accountable to that value. And so it's really hard for them to focus on that value.
You've also talked about a national database, the need for a national database. Talk more about that.
So there's lots of talk of different kinds of national databases. The Center for Policing Equity owns the National Justice Database. This is the largest collection of police behavioral data in the world, which is a super humble brag. Right? There's not a lot of good data. It's not collected very widely and well. And lots of places who talk about having it have pieces and bits and small things. Remember, there's 18,000 roughly law enforcement agencies across the United States. 75% of them are 25 officers or fewer, and 1,000 are one dude. It's always a dude, right? So they don't have good data, right? But still, having it in one place allows you to start learning things about how police are engaging in communities. But the long and short is this. We've measured in this country everything that matters to us, right? Amazon and Target know when the family gets pregnant by what you're searching for online, right? Your newspaper, if they're a big newspaper, knows when you're thinking about canceling your subscription. That's how we get the ads that we get. It is a $1 trillion industry to gather data and know what people are doing. And we have measured next to nothing about what the state does to the sons and daughters of former slaves in this country. That should be an outrage.
And why don't we?
Because we haven't cared. If we cared, we'd have measured it. Think about a single thing that you care about in your life. And if you really care, you measure it, even if it's only implicitly.
What about national standards for the use of force, or national policing standards in general?
So think about what police are tasked with, right? So a lawyer is tasked with deciding, making strong decisions about liberty. Lawyers and judges. Liberty, who gets to be free? Doctors are entrusted with the ability to make good decisions about life. Law enforcement has both responsibilities, life and liberty. You can't lose your license as a doctor in one state and then be like, I'm just going to try doctoring again in this next state over. You can't lose your certification as a lawyer in one state and say, I'm going to try lawyering someplace else. But you can do that in law enforcement because we don't have a national registry and we don't have a set of standards that say, if you fall below these standards, we will not entrust you with that badge and that gun with the license to take away life and liberty. That is ludicrous. And law enforcement, by the way, has mostly been calling for the same thing for years. Here, we do see a difference between leaders and unions, because for unions, it ends up being a burden, and for chiefs, it ends up being liberating.
You testified before the House. There is a piece of legislation put forth by House Democrats. So far, it is only Democrats. What would it do, and what is your evaluation of it?
So I encourage people to go to the Leadership Conference for Civil and Human Rights website. At civilrights.org. You can read all 8 of the pillars there. And in the time we've got right now, I think I probably can't get into great depth into all 8 of them. But I think what's really important is that this is, each one would be almost unimaginable 3 weeks ago, right? Each one of those 8 pillars. It does things like put a federal ban on all neck restraints, something that many major cities have done. But this would allow for federal litigators to come in and say, enough. We have jurisdiction here as well. It calls for a national registry of fired officers so that officers like Timothy Lohman, who killed Tamir Rice and had been referred for termination in the last department, he quit before he could be fired, and then was fired from Cleveland PD and now still works in law enforcement someplace else. That couldn't happen. Okay. It calls for an end to qualified immunity. There's a list of, again, 8 things, all of which have either a strong moral values-based reason for being there, or a strong scientific component, or both. What would it do? Functionally, it would begin the first step process of allowing our federal and local governments to hold police accountable in ways that right now we fail to every single time there's a shooting.
You've been doing this work for a long time. Does this feel like a different moment where there might be a large shift in the direction that you hope to see us go in?
So that's a double barrel question. Does it feel like a different moment? It does. After Ferguson, about 1/4 of the country said that racism in policing was systematic. Now we're up to 74%. I don't know where those 26% are looking, but the country has moved. We're talking about structural change and investment in Black communities, where before we were talking about pattern and practice investigations in law enforcement. This is a different moment. The people who I'm talking to in DC are talking about a need to act or losing the consent of the governed, right? And we're seeing ideas floated from the White House on racial justice. So that's a different moment. So are we gonna see lasting change? I don't know yet, right? Like I've been saying over and over again, the most important thing that people who are newly awakened and engaged in these issues can do is strap in. Because for sure, there's going to be more dead bodies. For sure, there's going to be more hashtags asking for justice for the families and accountability for the person who can't get justice anymore because they're lying on the ground. For sure, we're not solving this so that George Floyd is the last one. We've already seen that that's not going to be true. So it will depend on how many of us decide to be adults and strap in for the marathon that is accounting for 400 plus years of targeted oppression. We've had a couple of weeks of people kind of getting it. I don't think that's equal. So we're gonna need to put significantly more on the side of the scale that's justice to bend that long arc of the moral universe.
Professor Philip Atiba-Goff, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
And yes, the process has only just begun. And finally tonight, this image tells an incredible story. Patrick Hutchinson carrying a white protester out of harm's way in those London riots this weekend. Patrick tells CNN he was there with his community protective team when they saw one of the so-called far-right hooligans fall and get separated from his crowd. Hutchinson and his team swooped in, picked him up, and left him with the police. Hutchinson said that it was his natural instinct to protect, even though the man was up to no good against his community. And we also want to reflect tonight, not just on an image, but on the language we use. The current dictionary definition of racism cites 3 parts. In short, the belief that race produces superiority, a political or social system founded on racism, and lastly, racial prejudice or discrimination. But nowhere does it mention the centuries of institutional racism that we've been so focused on these last few weeks, until Kennedy Mitchum from Missouri wrote to Merriam-Webster about this crucial missing link. She explained having had too many unsatisfying debates with friends and others about what racism actually looks like. So she began an uphill climb with Webster's. Take a listen.
It was a lot of back and forth. I did have to fight, but they did say that they would change it to include more systemic aspects because that is very important, and that they would look into different research, different literature that includes what people of color have to say about the term before, you know, publishing it.
So her persistence paid off, and after all, this does depend on education. That's it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.